Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, as part of our focus on histories of our near neighbours, we're reopening the dossier on Australia's secret war with Indonesia. You might recall the spying row which erupted between Australia and our biggest neighbour back in November, including the tapping of the Indonesian president's phone and his wife's. Well, as we'll hear on the program today, there's a long history to that tension. In 1965 and 66, Australian troops fought a covert war inside Indonesian territory in Borneo. In fact, this information was kept so secret that only a handful of cabinet ministers knew of the military actions. The soldiers themselves were under strict instructions not to tell anyone, not even their wives. In 2007, when this documentary was first broadcast on Hindsight, it was the first time that the soldiers' stories were told in public. Confrontasi, Our Secret War, is produced by Tom Morton.
Cross-border operations were something that was not talked about at all, and indeed it was a very closely guarded secret at the time.
It was top secret for 30 years. From 1966 to 1996, it was top secret.
Before we ran across, it was clearly told to me that our trip across the border was to be totally unattributable. And that meant that we virtually carried no marked maps at all. We carried no paperwork. If we carried a notebook that had nothing in them, they were blank.
We had no trepidation about it at all. We knew we were going to go over. We wanted to go over.
There was an Indonesian sentry sitting on a raised seat, just like a tennis umpire, armed with what to me looked like a 5-inch calibre submachine gun, and he was staring straight at me.
The only possible trepidation that we had was that we couldn't expect helicopter support or artillery support or even mortar support, so we knew when we were over there that we were on our own.
The biggest risk that we had was the fact that we couldn't get any wounded out. We'd have to carry them out.
The soldiers weren't allowed to carry any letters or any means of identification other than the dog tags they wore around their neck. And indeed, I think the only thing that we left across the border was our footprints.
Rod Curtis, who was awarded the Military Cross for his service in Borneo. If you'd asked the average Australian in the early 1960s what they thought was the most dangerous challenge that we faced in our region, they'd almost certainly have said it was the confrontation between Indonesia and Malaysia and the possibility that Australia could be dragged into an open war with our nearest neighbour.
This is the front line of Indonesian confrontation, the border between Sabah and Sarawak and Indonesian Borneo. Commonwealth Army units are in the jungles seeking out guerrillas.
In the past few months, more than 250 Indonesian regular troops have been landed or airdropped into southern Malaya.
Australia is committed. Tim Bowden continues.
Australian troops are deeply involved in the defence of Malaysian Borneo. In fact, another battalion is due to arrive later this year. If the already weakened Malaysia cannot hold together, the Australian government will be placed in a very awkward predicament.
The big question here now is, will the new year bring bigger landings over a wider area? The answer to this question could well decide the difference between confrontation and war in 1965.
Confrontation was both a public and a highly secret war. At the height of the conflict, Indonesia launched paratroop raids on the Malaysian mainland. Australian troops were sent to Borneo to repel incursions by Indonesian guerrillas. At least that was the official story. Unofficially, our troops were themselves carrying out ambushes and patrols well inside Indonesian territory. These operations, codenamed Claret, were masterminded by the British military command.
The British called it a policy of moral attrition to try and grind down the Indonesians, increase tensions within the country to try and defeat the guerrillas on the border, on their side of the border, and therefore force Indonesia back down.
And there were times when the British were talking about major air attacks and using Darwin as a base for substantial air attacks on Indonesia, flying their V-bombers, which were capable of carrying nuclear bombs, flying them over Indonesia to frighten the Indonesians. And Australia was worried that this could escalate, you know, quite out of control.
Yet even at the most perilous moments in confrontation, war was never actually declared. Australia maintained diplomatic relations with Indonesia even while soldiers from both sides were shooting at each other in the jungles of Borneo. The true nature of confrontation was one of the most closely guarded secrets in Australian history, both at the highest levels in Canberra and on the ground in Borneo. David Thompson was commander of the 4th Royal Australian Regiment in Borneo in 1966.
Clout operations were never discussed outfully. And within the companies, if a patrol came back, they didn't tell the rest of the company what they were doing.
My company, Charlie Company, was in a forward operating base at Boka in Sarawak. And that was about 10 kilometres from the border region, and it was forward of Bau, where the battalion headquarters was located.
Only tried and trusted troops had been used. We had to wait a couple of weeks while we were tested before we were allowed to go over the border.
In that forward operation base, there were three platoon commanders of the company. I commanded 9 platoon, Max Chambers commanded 7 platoon, and Doug Byers commanded 8 platoon. Now, they both had done clout operations over the border operations, and I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't aware of the fact that both of those platoon commanders and their platoons had been across the border, and just remarkable that I hadn't got a hint of it.
Even your own wife didn't know, and you were the commanding officer.
And my wife didn't know, and none of the other wives, if they did know, they never talked to the other wives, because if one wife had spoken about it, it would have gone round the wives' net very quickly. And the diggers were wonderful. Even after a few drinks, they obviously didn't talk to their wives about it.
One thing that I've been really curious about, do you know where the name claret came from?
I think someone must be having a glass one night and decided that was a good name to call it.
October 1964, Jakarta, Indonesia. Armed Forces Day. The anniversary of the day in 1945 in which the People's Security Army was formed. After the first wave of successful revolution and the state of Indonesia was proclaimed, this army became the National Army.
So, why did we fight a secret war with Indonesia? And why was the story of that war kept under wraps for 30 years? It's almost impossible to imagine now just how volatile our region was in the early 1960s. Indonesia was barely 20 years old. Malaysia was a newborn nation. The long shadows of Dutch and British colonialism were slowly fading, but in their place, new rivalries were emerging, fueled by nationalism and the global competition of the Cold War.
It was all part of the process of the British decolonisation of their interest in this part of the world. There was at this time Malaya, Singapore was separate, and so were the British territories on the island of Borneo, Sabah, Sarawak and Brunei. And the thought was that they would be stronger if they were united under the title of Malaysia. Sukarno, President Sukarno in Indonesia, at first didn't seem to react too strongly to this, but then he started regarding it as an example of what he called Nekolim, neocolonialism and imperialism. He portrayed the view that this was basically the British hanging on to their interests in a disguised form and intruding on an island where most of which was part of Indonesia, known to them, of course, as Kalimantan.
Ganyang, Malaysia, or Crush Malaysia, has become a national rejoinder throughout Indonesia. Along Jakarta's streets, on hoardings that greet you almost at every turn, is the sign of aggression, the sign of force and provocation.
Sukarno objected to the inclusion of Sabah and Sarawak into Malaysia, and he declared, or his foreign minister, Dr. Subandrio, declared that their policy was one of confrontasi, confrontation, which left it open as to whether it was going to be diplomatic or military or a bit of both.
The song of Nazucom, the state ideology, which says, "Let's show our fists together, be united our strength. Let's go forward, Nazucom united. Remove the pig-headed. Nazucom's one ideal, socialism will triumph."
Sukarno was not himself a communist. He was a radical nationalist, but he was balancing three major sort of elements in Indonesian domestic politics. There was the rising Communist Party, the PKI, which was getting closer and closer to the Chinese Communist Party. There was a nationalist strand, and there was also the elements of an Islamist stand, as we would now say. And confrontation was a very useful device by which he could keep the communists and the army, who were anti-communists but strongly nationalists, on the same side.
That's Peter Edwards, who's the author of Crises and Commitments, the official history of Australia's involvement in Southeast Asian conflicts. President Sukarno had already taken on and defeated one colonial power, the Dutch, and now he would have to face another.
Britain at this time got very alarmed, the British got very alarmed at what Sukarno was doing, and they tended to portray the threat from Sukarno in the most alarmist terms. They explicitly compared him with Hitler at times and said that if the Western world backed down, if Sukarno took over what is now East Malaysia, he'd then move on and take over the Malayan Peninsula, he'd take over all of New Guinea, he'd move into Melanesia and so forth.
The British really were trying to maintain themselves as a global power, global military power. They created Malaysia as a way to decolonise, but also to chain access to the Singapore military base. And the Singapore base is very important in Britain's role as a power in the Far East. It is an important military base. For example, they plan to use bombers there to atom bomb China in case of a war. And the British saw confrontation by Sukarno, by Indonesia, as a way to try and drive them out of Singapore, try to break up Malaysia, but also force the British out of the military base in Singapore.
David Easter. Hanging on to Singapore may have been Britain's ultimate aim during confrontation, but the real theatre of war was Borneo. British authorities wanted to stop Indonesian troops linking up with what they believed was a strong covert communist organisation in Malaysian Borneo.
This is the front line of Indonesian confrontation, the border between Sabah and Sarawak and Indonesian Borneo. Commonwealth Army units are in the jungles seeking out guerrillas. It is a difficult country. The native Dayak people are politically unaware. For them, the 1,000-mile border is meaningless. Not so politically unaware are the Chinese. 8,000 were placed behind barbed wire following a raid on a Kuching police station. A secret Chinese communist group was blamed.
The British and Malaysian authorities in Malaysia were very concerned about the dissident Chinese communist elements in Borneo itself. From all my reading and research in the records, it has to be said, I think, that those concerns, whilst real, never actually seemed to have amounted to very much. The Chinese communist organisation had been pretty effectively dealt with during the emergency in the 1950s, and it doesn't seem to have played a very large or active role at any stage in the fighting in Borneo.
Geoffrey Gray, who's Professor of Military History at the Australian Defence Force Academy.
Where the Indonesians did have some advantages was much more with the Aboriginal people, the Iban and Dayak, whose traditional lands, of course, were divided by the stroke of a pen on a map, which meant absolutely nothing to them, and who in some parts of Borneo were, in fact, reasonably pro the Indonesians for personal and familial reasons. I remember talking to one Indonesian colonel who had been operating in Borneo in 1964-65, and he was actually married to a local Iban woman.
Our mission was to protect the local people, but also to prevent the Indonesian penetration into the interior of Sarawak, into the populated areas where they could mingle with the locals and carry out subversive activities, sabotage. The idea was to prevent them getting into the settled areas and doing any damage, and also harassing the tribal people. So it was a protection role along the border.
So that was the official side of the mission. There was, another side of the mission, which was unofficial and indeed kept top secret. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, the British senior officers that were running the campaign decided quite early that the way to stop the Indonesians coming across the border was to do preemptive raids and try and ambush them in Indonesia as they came over. And that proved to be quite successful. It kept the Indonesians off balance. There was a limit on how far we could go. The limit was 7,000 metres inside Indonesian territory. The Special Air Service, I think the limit for them was a little bit further. Those crossings were designed to find information on what the Indonesians were doing and then try to prevent them taking the initiative and get them off balance.
Brian Avery. Avery was a lieutenant with the 4th Royal Australian Regiment in Borneo. He's published a history of their operations there called Our Secret War. Avery led 10 platoon across the border into Indonesian territory on what was codenamed Operation Thunderball.
Basically, it was a patrol whose main aim was to locate an Indonesian position that had previously been undetected. So my job was to find out exactly where it was, do a close reconnaissance, find out what the Indonesians were doing there, you know, how many of them, what they were doing. And then having done that, I was then to move upstream from this camp and put surveillance along one of the rivers. There are no roads in the Indonesian side, and they used to use the rivers as their highways. And some of the successful ambushes took place on these rivers.
To get to the border to begin the operations, we had to climb up a mountain called the Gunung Raya, which was basically a razorback ridge which defined the border between West Malaysia and the Indonesian side. And it used to take us about 3 to 4 hours sometimes to get up the top. Sometimes we had to crawl up, especially if it had rained. It was terrible. And in most places it was pure jungle with trees 20 foot thick and 50, 60, 70 feet high, very humid, very close, and very physically exhausting.
Alan Price was an infantry corporal at the time, and he too went across the border on claret operations.
We had to move through large inland freshwater swamps, mangrove swamps, and that was very difficult going because the water varied between sort of ankle deep up to waist deep, and very slow and very exhausting for fully laden troops. And we got stuck in it at night, and I thought at one stage I'd probably have to put our hammocks up in trees and sleep over the water.
So you go out for 7 days or 14 days, come back in for 2 or 3 days, get everything prepared again, but in the meantime your feet were that waterlogged. You invariably had tinea, you had heat rash under your arms, on your chest, on your back, around your backside. And when we did come back from a patrol, we wouldn't wash our clothes, we'd just burn them.
Now, the Indonesian position was not very far away from a Dayak village, and that was the people who'd been doing the slash-and-burn agriculture. And we could actually hear the children and the roosters and the dogs and that in the village. So it was essential to keep our presence secret.
When you went up to do reconnaissance of the Indonesian position, you very nearly got spotted, didn't you?
Yes, the SAS patrol had reported that the Indonesian position was surrounded by a pig fence. And I stumbled upon this pig fence we went to ground to observe the position, and I became alarmingly aware that there was an Indonesian sentry sitting on a raised seat, just like a tennis umpire, armed with what to me looked like a 5-inch calibre submachine gun, and he was staring straight at me. But he didn't see me. There were 4 of us in the reconnaissance patrol. I'd left the platoon and its base, and we stayed there for the whole day and kept the position under observation, just lying in the undergrowth close to this pig fence. And at one stage, an Indonesian soldier came out of one of their bunkers, walked over to the pig fence and commenced to urinate over the fence,
almost on top of one of my soldiers who was lying observing.
It was tough for them. Close air support would not be given except in extreme emergency. We never used helicopters over the border, and there was no medical evacuation, helicopter evacuation for casualties. So if there were any casualties, they had to be carried back to the border where they were picked up by helicopter.
So, I mean, how did you feel at the time as a commander who was going across the border, knowing that you were participating in a highly secret operation and knowing that you were participating in a cross-border operation with a country with whom Australia wasn't officially at war?
Well, most of that didn't really concern me. I was simply doing my job. In hindsight, it wasn't so much the fact that we weren't at war with them. In hindsight, to me, it seemed to be very risky to send 30 men into Indonesia with the possibility of them getting into a firefight, had any men captured or killed, explaining to the Australian public how this happened inside Indonesia could have been a bit embarrassing to the government.
The Australian government had in fact been reluctant to commit troops to Borneo. Prime Minister Menzies had supported the creation of Malaysia, but during the early stages of confrontation, Menzies held out against strong pressure from both London and Kuala Lumpur to provide military aid.
The biggest factor from the Australian government's point of view was that once confrontation was dealt with, that we should be able to re-establish normal relations with our largest and most populous neighbour to our immediate near north. The Australian government's policy up to 1965 was very much that, yes, military force might well be needed, but not yet. And despite the pleas of the Malaysian and British governments on several occasions, particularly in the course of 1964, as Sukarno's promise that it would be a year of living dangerously seemed to be more and more coming to pass, the Australian government continued to say, yes, but not yet, essentially, until after the major incursions in the latter part of that year made it fairly clear that that was not a policy which would be tenable for very much longer.
In the past few months, more than 250 Indonesian regular troops have been landed or airdropped into southern Malaya.
Sukarno's paratroopers dropped into the Borneo jungle, but met a swift end as Malay troops mopped them up. A petty war, but in the perilous 60s, any war is a worldwide danger.
It was mainly Sukarno who escalated the confrontation. The British had started applying more pressure on Indonesia, as I said. But in August-September 1964, Sukarno really upped the stakes. Up until that point, Indonesia had been sending troops and guerrillas into Borneo, part of Malaysia. But now they openly sent troops into Malaya, Peninsula Malaya. And the British promised the Malaysians, if this carried on, they would start bombing targets in Indonesia. And the British started moving out large numbers of bombers, other planes, ships and troops to the region in readiness for open war against Indonesia.
Could well decide the difference between confrontation and war in 1965.
Both Britain and Indonesia backed away at the last moment from open war. But even before the paratroop raids on the Malaysian mainland, Britain had decided to pursue a range of covert countermeasures against Indonesian confrontation. These ranged from black propaganda to cross-border military raids and secret support for separatist movements within Indonesia. What you're about to hear now is some top secret advice which was sent from the Foreign Office to Cabinet in January of 1964. It's now been declassified and it gives us a fascinating insight into the British strategy.
As long as our conflict with Indonesia remains unofficial and bilateral, we retain the initiative. We can choose either to intensify it or to seek a settlement. Once we either internationalise it or turn it into a war, declared or undeclared, against a wicked aggressor, Her Majesty's government will be restricted in their freedom of action, both by public opinion at home and international pressure.
The international pressure which the Foreign Office was worried about was in fact pressure from one of Britain's own closest allies, the United States.
Although the Americans were getting very alarmed at other countries and other radical nationalists who were not quite communists but seemed to be too close to the communists, in the case of Indonesia, they took a very different line, and they were much more inclined to take an attitude which the Australians at times characterised as appeasement. In other words, they were willing to buy Sukarno off if it meant keeping him out of the communist camp. And the Indonesians played on this very skillfully. The Americans were much more inclined to go along with that. And they said, look, you Commonwealth powers, Australia, Britain, New Zealand, you can handle Sukarno, you can keep him under control without too much military effort.
At the time, Britain portrayed Indonesia as the aggressor and Malaysia as the victim of confrontation. Britain argued that she was simply defending the nation she'd helped to create against Sukarno's ambitions to dominate the region. But according to David Easter, the real story is a very different one. Easter has done extensive research in the archives and interviewed former officials about British aims. He says that the evidence he's gathered doesn't support the official account. In reality, says Easter, Britain pursued an aggressive war against Indonesia without the knowledge of the British public.
The British decided in 64 that they couldn't just remain defensive, they couldn't just try and stop the Indonesian guerrilla raids. They thought the war could go on indefinitely at higher and higher levels of cost for Britain. So they started to try and adopt a policy of attrition, try and gradually put pressure on Indonesia to try and force it to give up confrontation. The Foreign Office described at one point repaying Indonesians in kind, doing back to them what they were doing to Malaysia. And the British saw the way they could try and perhaps end this conflict, to try and squeeze Indonesians in return, that would force eventually Sukarno or maybe the military to back down and stop confrontation.
So, David Easter, are you saying then that in a sense both Britain and Indonesia were in a sense willing and active partners in confrontation? It wasn't just something made by Sukarno.
It was in a way a mutual confrontation. The British, as I said, weren't just flying a defensive. They were actually aggressively attacking Indonesia. But again, in a very secret way, in terms of propaganda and covert action, cross-border raids, to try and put the squeeze on the Indonesians. The British called it a policy of moral attrition, to try and grind down the Indonesians, increase tensions within the country, to try and defeat the guerrillas on the border, on their side of the border, and therefore force Indonesia to back down.
You're listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. And today, the story of our secret war with Indonesia.
It was a fascinating time and a very challenging time for Australian diplomacy because you should remember at this time, Australia's whole foreign policy and defence policy was based on the idea of forward defence, which basically meant keeping allied to the greatest extent possible with both Britain and the United States. People sometimes think that we'd changed over from Britain to the US in the 40s. That certainly wasn't the case. So there was the sense that this was really Britain's show and we did not want to be put too much into the front line.
Australia was by no means a purely passive player in what was an increasingly risky and potentially explosive diplomatic game. Our two major allies were pulling in quite different directions, but we managed to balance ourselves between them.
But it was not just a matter of balancing allies, that was a major part of it. But there was a very strong sense, particularly the diplomats in external affairs, that they wanted to make a truly Australian policy, which was influenced by alliance relationships, but not determined by alliance relationships. They were also determined to figure out a policy which was in Australia's national interests and in Australia's long-term national interests.
With increasing Australian military involvement in Malaysia, do you think Indonesia will modify its confrontation?
Well, I have, the government has followed a policy of a graduated response in this area. And more recently, as you heard last night, we have agreed to supply personnel and equipment to Malaysian forces.
Sir Garfield Barwick, who was then Minister for External Affairs, announcing the first deployment of Australian forces to Borneo in 1964. Those forces were to provide support for British and Malaysian troops and were to be used in a strictly defensive capacity. But in February 1965, Prime Minister Menzies announced that combat troops would be sent to Borneo. Opinion polls at the time showed that there was broad support amongst the Australian public. But what the public didn't know was what these troops would really be doing.
Well, opposite us was siding the Indonesian border camp that was the equivalent to our position on our side of the border. And it was supplied by boats running up and down a river. And the idea was that we would get across and ambush the river and see if we could slow down their resupply.
But also, obviously, to put some military pressure on them to let them know that you were prepared to conduct offensive operations.
Oh, yes, yes.
Pat Beale, he led a platoon from the 3rd Royal Australian Regiment across the border in May 1965. It was the first ambush operation by Australian troops in Borneo.
Being the first operation, I think there was a great degree of caution used in mounting it. We travelled down a ridge line for a distance of about 4 kilometres, I suppose it was, very slowly and very cautiously, as it seemed such an obviously ideal approach for anybody trying to get to the river, that we suspected that the Indonesians may well have it either patrolled or have mined it or put some sort of block along it at some stage. So we took it very slowly and very cautiously.
And you actually, as you were moving along the track there, you found an Indonesian cigarette packet, which caused you a bit of wry amusement, I think, didn't it?
It was from the English American Tobacco Company, I think was the label on it, specially packaged for the Indonesian armed forces. We slipped away fairly early in the morning, went down very cautiously to the river, and found that instead of it being, as we expected, a nice empty stretch of the river line, that we could move in at our leisure and put an ambush in position, that in fact it was another Indonesian base area. There was probably at least an Indonesian platoon just at the spot that we wanted to lay the ambush. And there was a lot of movement, a lot of noise, the occasional rifle shot. Presumably they were out hunting. Instead of into a deserted area, it was like coming into Pitt Street.
The next morning, Pat Beale decided to go ahead with the ambush.
It was really the more in the nature of a raid. It wouldn't be a long, deliberate ambush that we could have expected to have kept in position for days. So we decided to go back into the same area, cross the track, go down to the riverbank, hit whatever came along the river, and then get back out as quickly as possible, hoping that nobody came along behind us along that track. And so we moved into position and waited there for about 40 minutes, and along came 4 boats that we were able to engage. As the boats came down the river, there was a lot of yelling and talking, and the soldiers from the Indonesian camp that was just on the other side of the river wandered down to call out to their mates in the boats. So we had quite a crowd. The 4 boats, each with about 5 in them. The lead 2 boats came into the ambush area. We engaged them, and also the Indonesian soldiers on the other bank. We were able to sink the 4 boats and inflict casualties on a number of the Indonesian soldiers on the other bank.
One of the soldiers actually leapt into the water and swam away, and you had a moment there where suddenly you found you couldn't go on firing, yeah?
Yes, yes. One poor little bugger was sort of flogging around in the water trying to get away from our fire, and I eventually found that it was... I'm not a good shot at the best of times, but it was probably worse than I ever was. And that was really to my relief. I didn't like to sort of be quite as callous as it seemed, shooting this poor bloke swimming away. Unfortunately, he was seen by others in the ambush and met his end.
Were you under fire too while this was going on?
Oh, yeah, the Indonesian soldiers on the other bank, as soon as they had recovered from the initial burst of fire, started firing back at us, and it became quite intense, quite a gun battle across the river line.
But what was the end result of that gun battle then?
Well, once the boats had been sunk, our job was finished, and we really needed to get out of there as quickly as we possibly could.
Beall took his platoon back across the border without casualties. A few days later, they discovered that the Indonesians had chosen to suppress all news of the Australian ambush.
This fairly routinely was mentioned on some Indonesian radio station a couple of days later, saying that there had been a training accident and that a group of Indonesians, I forget really with the number now, I think it was probably 13 that they credited us with, had been killed in this training accident. They never confirmed that it was on their side of the border. And of course, that was the whole irony of these claret operations, that they were kept very secure and very secret, except by those who were actually fighting them. The Indonesians knew what we were doing, we knew what we were doing, but we hoped that nobody else did.
As soon as it was a claret operation went over the border, there was a fake operation with the operation order and positions and orders on our side of the border. And that map was marked up. And the claret map, of course, was always kept covered. But this one was probably the press, and anyone could look at that one.
David Thompson, who commanded the 4th Royal Australian Regiment in Borneo in 1966. He later went into politics and became a minister in the Fraser government. David Thompson calls the claret operations a masterpiece of political guile. It was his job to keep them secret, even from visiting cabinet ministers. This involved an elaborate system of faked records and dummy maps.
Yes, we had two maps in the operations room, one on our side of the border and one map on the other side of the border. The claret map, the claret operations on the other side of the border was always kept covered, and there was always a sentry on duty so people didn't get in to look at it. The press never saw it, with one exception.
Well, I understand that you also had to keep it secret from a number of quite high-level political visitors, including the Attorney General at one point.
Yes. The Prime Minister, of course, knew. The Minister of Defence knew. And they were about the only ministers. We had other ministers who visited us, and so we took them into the public room and briefed them on operations our side of the border, all of which were fake, of course. And they didn't know. The ones that were cleared for claret were given proper briefings. The ones that weren't cleared weren't given proper briefing. They were given the fake briefing.
If it had been blown in the Western media, then the Indonesians would have lost face, and that would have meant that they would have had to have fought a far more emphatic war than they were fighting. And it was best done without embarrassing the Indonesians too much, publicly.
Yes, you say in your book the Indonesians were keeping to their part of the bluff, saving face and by denial, also keeping open the door to a compromise settlement. And you go on to say, it was ironic that it was a secret that we shared with our enemy. I mean, that's a very telling phrase.
yes, it was. They didn't want the embarrassment of being seen for the world to know that we, in fact, were crossing into their territory.
Pat Beall later received the Military Cross for his service in Borneo. Now there's a further strange twist to the story of our secret war. We now know that British intelligence had succeeded in cracking the Indonesian diplomatic and military codes. From their listening post in Singapore, British and Australian intelligence officers got advance warning of troop movements and Indonesian strategic planning.
They also learned, quite bizarrely, that the Indonesian local commanders on the ground in Borneo weren't reporting cross-border operations to the Indonesian government. They were trying to make up stories of their own. They claimed fictitious raids of their own over the border. They just made up stories of their own successes and hid any evidence of British cross-border raids.
The senior leadership of the Indonesian army was generally opposed to Sukarno's policy in waging the war. They recognised that if they provoked the British and Commonwealth forces beyond a certain point, that they would end up, one, with a general war in the region, which was in nobody's interests, but two, that they would simply not be able to handle the level of military challenge that a full mid-intensity conflict would bring about. And they quietly, initially, and more openly as Sukarno's own position became weaker, worked to limit the extent to which Indonesian operations could indeed provoke a wider response.
In the early stages of confrontation, the Indonesian military didn't actively undermine President Sukarno's policy.
The army were good soldiers. The Indonesians were good soldiers. They had their orders. They were in the middle of a war, albeit a low-level one, albeit an undeclared one, but they were in the middle of a war, and they were good soldiers. They had good discipline, and their senior officers were not about to openly defy the orders of the constitutionally appointed head of the state, i.e. President Sukarno.
But as confrontation wore on, growing tensions emerged between Sukarno and sections of the military, who believed that the president was getting too close to the Indonesian Communist Party. At this point, Britain sensed an opportunity.
The Information Research Department of the Foreign Office that carries out covert propaganda, it created a special unit in Singapore in February 1965 called the Southeast Asia Monitoring Unit, or SIMU. And this carried out black propaganda against Indonesia. The British felt their weaknesses on the Indonesian side they could exploit. The British sent over their expert on propaganda from the Middle East, a man named Norman Redaway. And at the same time, there was an abortive coup attempt in Indonesia on 30th of September 1965. It failed to succeed, but it managed to kill six leading Indonesian generals. And the military blamed the coup on the Indonesian Communist Party, the PKI.
These are the cries that have echoed through Jakarta streets for the past week. Abuse and threats heaped on the head of the Communist Party. This group is being spurred on by an army officer. For although the army is non-political, it's using the non-communist student and other mass organisations to back up its demands that the party be banned.
And the British tried to re-encourage army to act against the PKI, to try and destroy the PKI, which they saw as big backers for the confrontation policy. And also to act against Subandjo, the foreign minister, and also, ultimately, act against Sukarno.
Is that quite clear, that Britain actively encouraged the army to act against the communists and against Subandrio and Sukarno?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There are clear documents of British actually giving signals to the army they want them to do this. The British told the Indonesian army they'd need to worry about military action during the confrontation. The British wouldn't attack them if they need to use their forces, pull them back from Borneo and Kalimantan to use against the communists inside Java. The British gave clear signals that they could do this.
I remember one senior commander who had been in the northern area of Borneo for some time saying to me that he knew full well where his enemy was, and he was in his rear areas, that he had lists of those who were known PKI members.
Communist Party members.
Yes. He knew that they had lists that had been prepared of those who were opposed to them, and particularly in the middle months of 1965, he said his major focus was on his own rear areas and not across the border.
I'm standing right in the middle of a massive demonstration by groups, student groups of all religions, Muslim, Protestant, Catholics, who have arrived at the National Front to ask for the banning of the PKI here in Indonesia.
That is why we have to eliminate PKI. We don't like PKI.
What is Pancasila?
And the British tried to put stories onto Radio Malaysia, onto the BBC, onto Voice of America and Radio Australia, to try and make sure the communists got the blame for the coup attempt, to try and give encouragement to the army to act against the communists.
Some members of the PKI were involved in the murder of the generals and the abortive coup which followed. But there was no clear evidence that the coup had been planned or authorised by the leadership of the PKI.
And it's worth bearing in mind, this is the same time when the army is actually not just suppressing the communists but carrying out whole-scale massacres. The army and Muslim groups in Indonesia between October and January 1966 killed a huge number of people. We don't know how many, maybe 300,000, maybe 500,000 people were killed.
On the 19th of December, the Australian ambassador in Jakarta, Mick Shan, sent a telegram to Canberra.
In many cases, the massacre of entire families has occurred because one member spoke to the communists. Some of the methods adopted are unspeakable. It has been a bloodbath of savage intensity, remarkably unpublicised and locally regarded with a ghoulish cynicism.
But as I say, I mean, the British didn't allow that to hinder their propaganda. It was a weapon they could use to try and end confrontation, a weapon they could use against Sukarno and a weapon in the Cold War. And they were quite prepared to use this, no matter what the consequences.
By May 1966, Indonesia and Malaysia had begun peace talks. But on the border in Borneo, confrontation continued. An Indonesian patrol slipped over the border and entered an Iban village. They asked for food and a guide, but the Iban people alerted nearby Australian troops. Rod Curtis was sent out to intercept the Indonesian patrol as it attempted to cross back over the border. They took up an ambush position on the mountain ridge of the Gunung Raya.
Around about 5:20 in the afternoon, one of the soldiers gave me the enemy sign, the thumbs down sign, that he had seen some movement and that something or somebody was approaching our position. I counted four Indonesian soldiers come onto the track, and there was indeed a fifth soldier. They moved very cautiously down the track. They're obviously well-trained soldiers. When they were about 20 metres or so from my position, the lead soldier, Indonesian soldier or scout, squatted down and checked the track. They took a few more steps towards our position, and they were about 18 metres at that stage, and so I initiated the ambush and engaged those soldiers that I could see.
So you opened fire, yeah?
Opened fire, yeah. The first two soldiers dropped to the ground, and I was not able to see what happened to the other two soldiers. There was no fire at that stage coming back towards us, and so I called a ceasefire and got my soldiers to stop firing and stood up to try and find out what was going on. As soon as I stood up, I was fired upon, so I got back down again and we recommenced firing. I threw a couple of grenades. The first one didn't go off, the second one did, and that landed in the vicinity of where the other Indonesians were.
During the firefight, one of the Australian soldiers, Private Richards, had been shot. While he was treated by a medic, Rod Curtis and Private Rick Anderson tried to move in closer to the enemy.
We'd only gone forward a few metres when, you know, we both came under fire again. And at about that time, one of my corporals, a Corporal Eddie Lang, who had been in a stop position further to the east, came down the ridgeline on the northern side of the ridgeline, running down, and he was going to bring his section down. He was trying to determine what was going on, and virtually ran probably 20 metres to the north of where the Indonesian soldiers were. Both I and Private Anderson, Rick Anderson, yelled out to him to get down, but he didn't hear us, and he was engaged and shot through the chest. Shortly after that, Max Chambers, the platoon commander of 7 Platoon, and a section of his men came down between Max and I, were able to direct fire onto the remaining Indonesians, and they were both killed. Both Corporal Lang and Private Richards were wounded at that particular time. We then had to make litters, stretchers for them. They were given morphine. Their wounds were patched up and the bleeding was stopped, and we then had to carry them about 1,000 metres to a helicopter winch point or landing point. The canopy was too high to bring in helicopters to where we were to winch them out. The carry of those soldiers took about 5 hours over really tough jungle terrain. We got to the helicopter landing site, which is where the company headquarters was located, at about 1:30, I guess, or thereabouts in the morning. And RAF Whirlwind helicopter came in and took out both Richards and Lang. subsequent to that, Private Richards actually died of the wounds that he received, and Lang made a full recovery.
Rod Curtis was subsequently awarded the Military Cross for his bravery during the firefight on the Gunung Raya. And some documents found on the body of one of the dead Indonesian soldiers revealed that they were members of the RPKAD, the forerunner of the present-day Kopassus. Even at this late stage of confrontation, the RPKAD were apparently still attempting to encourage an insurgency inside Malaysian Borneo.
This is where the trial of Colonel Untung, accused leader of the coup, is being held. Beneath the girders of Indonesia's tallest building, one of the last reminders of the Communist Party, the PKI, is still to be seen, even though it's been painted over. Kill, I did. They did.
Ultimately, it was the takeover of power by the Indonesian military in 1966 which eventually brought confrontation to an end. A peace agreement was signed between Indonesia and Malaysia in August 1966, and not long afterwards, President Sukarno was replaced by a previously little-known general called Suharto. In Australia today, confrontation is a largely forgotten episode in our recent history. It's not well known, for example, that it was in fact confrontation which was the catalyst for the introduction of national service, and not the war in Vietnam. And both those who are directly involved and historians now see confrontation as a successful example of the limited use of force and skillful diplomacy. But would it have been so successful if it hadn't been so secret? David Thompson.
I suppose it's called a sensible war, if there's such a thing. It was as sensible as you could be, because the security was so important for both sides.
Look, I'll ask you this because you later on went on to have a career in politics yourself. You were a minister in the Fraser government. A lot of people might argue now that it's wrong for military operations which involve putting Australian service people at risk potentially in the way of harm to be kept secret from the public, that the public has a right to know about such things. What would be your response to that?
My response, it's going on today in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, there's very little public information on Afghanistan. There's been lots of contacts. Fortunately, we haven't had anyone killed. We've had a number wounded. But the security is the same as it was back there. There hasn't been anyone killed. Had there been people killed, it would have been much more public. Difficult to keep deaths secret. Keeping wounded secret is much easier.
Our Secret War was written and produced by Tom Morton. The sound engineer was Philip Ullman. Next Sunday on Hindsight, as part of our summer season about our Asia-Pacific neighbourhood, we're telling the story of blackbirding, when thousands of Melanesian people were brought to work here as indentured labour in the cane fields of Queensland. That's Island Footprints next Sunday at 1, here on Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. My thanks today to Mark Don. The news is next, here on RN.